U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Hurricane Ian still doing horrific damage in Florida as we tape this program, and could do, in fact, a second landfall in South Carolina in the coming days. Can Joe Biden and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis cooperate to mutual benefit regarding the handling of this hurricane? And what about hurricanes and climate change? Plus, Russia annexes four territories it occupies in Ukraine after phony referendums, saying that the people there wanted to join Russia, while the U.S. agrees to send more military aid to Ukraine. And NATO says a pipeline with Russian gas intended for Europe was sabotaged. Who's winning in these latest fronts in the Ukraine-Russia war? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and here with Kim Strassel and Jillian Melcher. Welcome to you both. Let's first talk about the hurricane. Of course, we don't know the extent of the damage still unfolding. It's certainly severe from all the pictures, just horrifying. And particularly, we don't yet know the number of people who will have died or been injured here. And we have to find that out, and we will. And our thoughts, of course, go to all the people who are enduring this. We also don't know exactly what the consequences will be. We have an election coming up, obviously. Ron DeSantis is on the ballot. Historically, Kim, hurricanes have been able to do great harm to politicians, depending on how they handle it. Of course, Katrina in 2005 being the classic example, but also can be a significant benefit if you are seen to be handling it well. The example there to mutual benefit, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, and Barack Obama in 2012, on the cusp of that election, the so-called hug, as the two met each other. It was really more like a close handshake between Obama and Christie after Superstorm Sandy. Christie widely criticized by some Republicans for seeming to get too close to Obama. On the other hand, it really helped Christie in his reelection the next year, and it arguably helped Obama too. I mean, I hate to get political here when the storm is still doing damage, but talk a little bit about that.
Well, right now, I guess we'll have to see how this turns out for both of them, but I think there's the opportunity for this to be mutually beneficial to both of them. One interesting thing about watching DeSantis do this is he's become known on the national stage very much as a political pugilist, taking shots at Democrats, really being a spokesperson for Republican causes. He's had a very different look this week, very much the executive in charge, very serious, grave, and so far is coming across as competent. On the other side, Biden started to potentially make a misstep there because he got some flack. He had talked to a number of mayors in Florida, but had not called DeSantis. And there was a lot of questions about that. Then he finally did. And of course, according to the White House, it was all cordial, and he has pledged all the help he can give. He's also made a major disaster declaration. That seems to me more the right move for the White House, to look generous and helpful rather than to allow politics to get in the way here. We'll see if that remains. I think the real risk for DeSantis is he needs to show himself to be competent in this, because otherwise he risks double damage, not just failing to help Florida, but looking as though he's really more of a talker than a doer, and that could harm him in his reelection.
All right, Kim, we shall watch. Now, just a word on climate change and hurricanes. Of course, the inevitable happened. I saw an AP story immediately upon the arrival of Hurricane Ian linking this serious storm, and it is a serious storm, something like the, in terms of wind, fourth most serious hurricane to hit Florida in the modern era, with 150 mile an hour hurricane winds. And the AP story and others saying, this is just shows you what climate change. I just want to read from the UN report, latest report, IPCC, on climate change. Quote, there is still no consensus on the relative magnitude of human and natural influences on past changes in Atlantic Ocean hurricane activity, and particularly on which factor has dominated the observed increase. And it remains uncertain whether past changes in Atlantic hurricane activity are outside the range of natural variability. That's bureaucratic prose for saying We don't know what the link is between climate and hurricanes. And there's actually no real confidence, even low confidence, among all different scientists about that link. Jillian, that won't stop people from making the link.
Yeah, that's right. I think this is just a really good example of some of the journalistic malpractice that happens around climate science in general. If you were to read the headlines, you would think you could draw a direct line from climate change to this particular hurricane. But I just think when you look at even what some of these scientists, capital scientists, are saying, they're not that certain about it. So I just think the media does not do a good job of covering this, and it's something that the public should be aware of.
There is some evidence that maybe the severity of tropical cyclones, typhoons in the Pacific, and hurricanes might be increasing because of climate change, but not the frequency, but less confidence in increase in frequency. All right. We'll follow these debates as they go. Let's move on to Ukraine and lots of developments there with regarding Russia's annexation of these territories in Ukraine that it occupies, but nobody else is recognizing other than the Russia's clients and various rogue states. But what difference is this annexation, Jillian, going to make on the ground, if any?
Well, so I think what Putin's trying to do here is potentially set up the circumstances for claiming that this is part of Russia, and that would allow him to potentially escalate by saying that any attempt by Ukraine to take back this territory, this occupied territory, is an attack on Russia. And so he's using that in conjunction with renewing his nuclear threats. And I think the attempt here is to intimidate the West. The West is completely right, by the way, in not acknowledging the legitimacy of these annexations. I mean, I was looking at polling that happened before the war, where only 21% of residents in Kherson, 32% of residents in Zaporizhia, those are two of the annexed territories, had warm attitudes toward Russia. And that was before the Russian soldiers began bombing Ukrainian cities, killing Ukrainian civilians. So it's not legitimate, and it's good to see the West not accept this. But I do think that's what Putin is trying to do. He also needs to have a victory for back home that's potentially also aimed at a domestic audience.
Yeah, I think you're right. I guess there, Kim, there is the risk of also as much speculation that possibly Putin is doing this to be able to drive home the threat that he has made about the potential use of nuclear weapons in defense of the Russian homeland, claiming that these territories are part of the Russian homeland, and therefore he is justified in using nuclear weapons. Of course, that would come, that decision, no matter whether those territories are annexed or not, with enormous consequences and very negative consequences for Russia as well. So that would still be a very, very high risk strategy.
Yeah, this came via a statement he made in which he said that Russia reserved the right to, quote, use all the means at our disposal, end quote, to keep territorial integrity. And so that's clearly what this is aimed at. And the risk, I think, escalates. Although it's interesting, a lot of people who follow this still remain skeptical he would do it because of all the complications involved, not just the potential for backlash and some sort of counterstrike potentially by NATO or others, the escalation of this, but also the problems just simply involved in using a nuclear or radiological weapon on the ground where his own troops are. It doesn't sound as though the Russian army is prepared to actually handle that themselves. One more thing that I would note that I think is maybe behind this territorial annexation, because it's very Putin-like and it's very cynical. Watch this space. But there's a lot of belief that in as soon as this is formalized, that the order will go out to conscript Ukrainians from these territories to serve in the Russian army, essentially use Ukrainians themselves as cannon fodder in part of this effort. And also think of it as psychologically, maybe perhaps make the Ukrainian army a little bit more reluctant to attack what they would know would be Ukrainian citizens. So given the difficulties Putin is having with this partial mobilization he has announced, they're high betting that that is an order that comes next.
Further complicating the war effort. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll come back more on Ukraine, particularly the U.S. adding more aid for the Ukraine military and a potential sabotage of a gas pipeline to Europe, plus a listener question on student loans when we come back.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here with Jillian Melcher and Kim Strassel. Let's talk about the military aid announced this week for Ukraine from the United States, because it's picking up on two fronts. One, $12 billion more in aid that's included in the continuing resolution spending bill that is likely to pass Congress this week. And that is something that both parties are supporting. And then there is the administration announcement this week that it is also is going to make from a drawdown from a previous legislation, $1.2 billion in aid for Ukraine, including 18 more HIMARS, which are the highly accurate rocket systems, missile systems that Ukraine has used to great effect against Russian targets, particularly logistics and command and control posts. And they have 16 of those already. And the new announcement says they will be getting 18 more. But here's the catch. They're not getting them right away. They're going to take as long as 3 years because the U.S. has to let contracts and ramp up production, Jillian. So good news and bad here. And there's more to this aid package than just HIMARS. But why is the administration waiting that long to deliver these HIMARS to Ukraine?
Well, I can't speak on behalf of the administration on this. But one concern that I am hearing increasingly is that the U.S., it's given a lot of this equipment to Ukraine, and we need to make sure that our own reserves are healthy. So that's one concern that I'm starting to hear. The $1.1 billion, it's not being done under drawdown authority. It's being done under Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which is a different program. It basically allows the United States to procure capabilities from the industry. And so there's a bit of a lag there. On the positive side, like you said, I think this signals long-term U.S. commitment for Ukraine, which is a good thing, especially as Putin is making these nuclear threats. On the flip side, they really need this equipment now. The Biden administration has not ruled out also sending aid as it is waiting for this to be procured. They're conducting a really effective counteroffensive right now. And when you do something like that, there's a lot of wear and tear on your equipment. The 16 HIMARS have been okay so far, but there's going to be tanks lost. You still have units in Ukraine that are lacking really basic things like night vision goggles, sufficient body armor. And if you look at the list of what this will provide, it does address some of that, some of the equipment that will get damaged over the course of the war. But one thing I noticed that it does not include is ATACMS. And those are missiles that you can shoot from the existing HIMAR platforms, but that have a lot longer range. This would allow Ukraine to attack Russian positions in Ukraine from a further distance. That keeps their troops a lot safer. So the Biden administration hasn't gone that far yet. And that's something to keep an eye on in the future.
Kim, the $12 billion military aid package, an additional military aid that will be moving as part of this continuing resolution spending bill, is significant politically to me in that there was some concern that after the $40 billion package passed earlier this year, that pretty much exhausted the American political patience for aid to Ukraine. 68 Republicans in the House and Senate, I think, was the number voted against that aid. Now, this is going to be part of the broader spending bill that is a must-pass legislation. So it's not going to get a standalone vote. But the lack of squawking about it, I think, does suggest that there's still bipartisan political support for helping Ukraine, and has probably been, and no doubt been, aided by the Ukrainian success on the battlefield.
Absolutely. And it's very good to see. I would note that this is a little bit less than what the White House had wanted. They had asked for 13.7. So this is about 1.4 billion less. But there is broad agreement among Democrats and Republicans to include it. Especially, it was just good to see, because in the beginning, some of the Republicans began by insisting that this be a clean CR and that this not be attached. They've all generally now come around to it. You may have some members of both sides who disagree, who sort of stand on the principle that we shouldn't be spending this money overseas right now, etc. We should be spending it at home, but I expect those to be very few. In terms of what's in the bill, there's about $3 billion in there for new weapons and logistical and intelligence support for Ukraine military. There's some $3.7 billion in another presidential drawdown authority. And there's also some money committed to replenishing U.S. stocks, and then a big tranche of it, more than $4 billion, to stabilizing the Ukrainian government and its economy, helping out on a humanitarian and civil front. So it's a good round package and one that pretty much fulfills all the president's requests, or I should say rather the Pentagon's requests about what is really needed to help Ukraine right now.
One point to reinforce what Jillian was saying before about U.S. stocks. There's no question that the U.S. has, in supplying Ukraine, has really drawn down some of its stocks of weapons, Javelin, anti-tank missiles in particular. Several years at least of those stocks have been drawn down. So there's a great need for the United States to replenish those stocks, and fairly rapidly. And I know the administration is reluctant to ask for too large a package, but I think we have to think about that. And in the new Congress, this is going to have to be a priority of restocking American armaments because of the many contingent, not just Ukraine, but the many potential contingencies around the world, not least in Taiwan. Another development here, NATO pipeline sabotage. NATO says that gas pipeline from Russia to Europe has been sabotaged with a leak that was discovered this week. Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO chief, saying we believe it's sabotage. Some are suspecting that is Russia behind it. Russia denies it. There is the idea that Russia is trying to hurt the European economy, even though that pipeline seems to supply only about 5% of Europe's needs. Jillian, we have to have an investigation into whether this is Russia. I'm not so sure it would be smart for Russia to do this, because I think it's just going to make Europe more determined to wean itself from Russian oil and gas.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. And you're also right that there's a lot that we don't know about this situation right now. So it's hard to give high-level analysis until more facts come out on it.
But we can give low-level analysis.
We can give some we can give some analysis on the energy situation. And I think that Russia has been pretty effective over the last many years in trying to use energy to blackmail Europe. But now you're seeing a big rethinking on this. It's something that Europe is beginning to realize is a huge vulnerability and try to wean itself off of Russian energy. So I think when, you know, if it does come out that Russia was behind these acts of sabotage, this would be another reason for pause and for skepticism about that ongoing, you know, dependency on Russian energy. I think the question now for Europe is, how are you going to fill that need? They're left. You've got a lot of people thinking that you can fill it with green energy, but we know that that's not as reliable. And so that raises very big questions about what Europe's energy future is going to look like, to the extent to which they will rely on nuclear. I've even seen some talk in Britain lately about potentially engaging their own energy extraction. So it's a fascinating thing to watch right now.
It indeed is, and all the more reason for the U.S. to ramp up its production of oil and gas, especially liquefied natural gas, which Europe is going to need a lot more of since it won't allow much fracking at all on its own territory. So that's shale fracking for natural gas. So it's going to have to import it from places other than Russia. It's getting some from Qatar now, I think some from Algeria, and some from the United States, but it's going to need a lot more as the years go on. Before we end, a letter from a listener regarding student loans and the judicial standing rules, and a very thoughtful letter. I thought we'd try to answer that. It's from Julian LaFleur, and he makes the point that with the president's recent plan to forgive $10,000 to $20,000 of student debt, there have been a number of discussions on who could stop this plan in court. The answer seems to be that very few people can stop the plan in court because interested parties lack standing. I was wondering if you could discuss standing, where it comes from, and its good and bad points. Thank you for that question, Julian. The judicial standing doctrine, if you will, is really a doctrine laid down by the Supreme Court about who can sue and why. And it's developed in the common law and in the Supreme Court cases over the years. And the issue of standing is pretty strict. The Supreme Court has developed a strict standing, and I think appropriately so, because you don't want the courts flooded with frivolous lawsuits. The Supreme Court handles cases and controversies, and that means examples of specific damage or harm that an individual plaintiff can show, allege, and then presumably show in a court of law. And you want people to have that, to be able to show that particularized damage, not just a generalized sense that, oh, I'm aggrieved, but I've been harmed financially, I've been harmed in some way to my person or in some way to my reputation, so that you can bring a case and have it adjudicated based on the evidence and the two sides in a back and forth in the legal system. And the standing problem for people in this example of student loan debt, even though we think what the president did, I think, is illegal, is that the general taxpayer does not have a particularized injury. Right, Kim?
Right.
It's somebody who, I mean, I'm injured every time Congress overspends, but you can't bring a case about it. So the question is, who is able to sue with standing? Because otherwise your case will be dismissed in court for lacking standing. Now, we finally have a case here this week, which is being brought by somebody who says, because of the loan write-off, even which he will get, that $10,000, $20,000, he will be damaged because he's going to have to pay taxes on it in Indiana. And therefore,
which he wouldn't have had to do via the program he's currently in. Ultimately, his debt would go away, but he wouldn't pay taxes. But now, given the president's program, he will face an immediate tax hit.
That's right. So that is a potential case that will be heard in a court of law on standing. There is also one other possibility here, which is that the United States House of Representatives or the Senate, if Republicans take either body, likely the House, in this year's election, they can sue, might be able to sue in a court of law, claiming that their power of the purse under the Constitution, their power to appropriate money, which is in Article 1 of the Constitution reserved for the Congress, has been violated. And there was a case that the House of Representatives brought in the Obamacare era when subsidies that Obama was spending for health policies was not directly appropriated by Congress in a specific case. The House brought a case and they won at the district court level. Now, it wasn't adjudicated because it went away after a variety of reasons and never waded up to the Supreme Court. But if Republicans take the House, Kim, they may bring that kind of suit, and it'd be fascinating to see how that would fare up to the Supreme Court. I think because this case is, in my view, so egregious, $400 billion, so much money, if not more, and no congressional authority, they might win that case.
Yep, exactly. It was interesting when they won that first time around. I mean, it was a pretty well-reasoned decision as well, too. I was hopeful that it would have survived judicial scrutiny as it moved its way up. And I think it's highly likely we get another situation like this if Biden moves ahead. The question is, he's going to begin forgiving this loans in a matter of weeks. And obviously, the election isn't happening for another month. And then Republicans won't take over for after that, which is why I'm more interested just at the moment over this lawsuit filed by the individual in Indiana. I'm also watching it. I'm a bit surprised. I think the other entities that could potentially have a claim here are loan servicers or debt collectors who can argue that they would be injured because loans are simply going away and therefore taking away an expected profit that they would have had. I'm kind of surprised that no one in any of those fields has filed a lawsuit, but there's murmurs that one might be coming.
All right, Kim, thank you very much. Thank you, Julian LaFleur. Appreciate the question. Thank you, Kim Strassel. Thank you, Jillian Melcher. Thank you all for listening. We're back every day on Potomac Watch, and we hope to have you with us tomorrow in another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.